Another Koban tradition I like to maintain is to see if anybody in the group has any question that they're anxious to put forth. Not necessarily to get an answer to, because the answer might not be forthcoming if there is an answer. But sometimes it's good to put forth a question if you have one within that needs to be shared. Or if somebody just has a comment they would like to make, not a question, it'd be a good chance to do it. You know. Koban, of course, was able to take any question or comment and turn it into a Dharma talk. I certainly don't claim to do that, but once again, sometimes it's good to just open that possibility up to somebody who has something to say before.
It's about keeping eyes open when we meditate, when we do sit zazen, because sometimes my eyes want to close, and when they close, it feels very peaceful, and I feel like, I guess I would say, more alert and more whole. And so I wondered if that, I've always been instructed that they should be somewhat open. And is that necessary? And maybe sometimes my body just says, you can do this better if your eyes are closed. And if that's possible or valid? Or
I could answer that.
Wow.
Only because a number of things. I'll start with the most relevant to Jokoji, which is that there was a priest who lived here for a while named Ruho, and he was a friend of Koban's. He was from Japan. And he was a Shinto priest, too, but I think he was also a Zen priest, but he sort of did Shinto more. And he knew a lot and knew a number of big, important people in Zen in Japan. So I mentioned, because I've had a practice of doing yoga where your focus of meditation is your third eye, really, and not so much, and sometimes your heart, but not so much with your eyes closed. And I mentioned that to him, and I said, well, it was always more comfortable for me. I just started that way. And in fact, my Zen teacher told me it was more comfortable for her that way. And she asked her Roshi, who was, I think, the guy in L.A. for a long time, years back.
I assume.
Yeah, yeah. And he said, that's fine. And what Ruho said to me was, that's secret place. That's, the standard Zen is for the general public, for the masses. But people sort of, adepts or people who are sort of already have something going on in that way, well, that it's more appropriate for different focus spots.
And which is which?
Both are good.
Which is that way? I'm confused as to with the eyes closed, eyes open, which you're associating with the different...
Well, more like yoga, which the Buddha originally was a yogi, is focusing with your eyes closed. And it's a natural, comfortable thing. And I experienced it that way, and other people pretty much got confirmation. It's not a big deal, but generally the standard instruction, for a number of reasons, is that standard way, that the classical way of doing Zen. Yeah, of course.
So the classical way, you're saying, is the eyes open.
Yeah, or slightly open. You're looking at the floor, or you're looking down a little bit, about 2 feet away or something. Okay. Yeah, that's the standard way. So I've never really spent much time doing it with the eyes open. A little bit. But it wasn't nearly as rewarding as with eyes closed. The only thing is, if you find yourself getting kind of dreamy and not really being grounded in a way, then you might want to open your eyes. If I'm falling asleep also, then I have to open my eyes, because then keep myself from falling asleep and really focus. That's all I have to say about that. Anybody else might want to share? I don't know.
I tend to follow the classical way, use the term that John used, the Zazen instruction I was given over 40 years ago. And so with the eyes partially open, gazing down and facing the the wall, towards the few feet above the floor. I find that when my eyes close, sort of automatically, unfortunately, because I tend to not be present when my eyes close. It gets me off into other places, or the sleepy place. So I feel more alert, more present when I maintain my eyes open, partially open state, then unfocused vision state.
Recently, I read The Middle Way by the Dalai Lama, which was very helpful, by the way, and helped explain what I chant, I suppose, in the Heart Sutra, which is about emptiness in the beginning of the sutra. And they talk about, I'm not sure who wrote it, it's written about the emptiness of the five aggregates. What does that mean? I thought of geology or something. So anyway, later, as I discovered, it's really about the five senses, I believe. The five aggregates, one of them being sight, in which I have been, all of us really, sort of primary sense linked up a lot in the brain. And I think, and still growing, but it's, this is part of the practice, is to be, understand, and to meditate, I suppose, on emptiness, empty of inherent existence. So if something is so predominant as the sense of sight, and yet empty of inherent existence, to have your eyes open, and I think what Peter said, to be in the presence, the present. I think that's why, in some ways, it's somewhat, for me, aids a lot. I've been in the meditation here, if I want to call it that, and I've witnessed the event of seeing, and I could almost see the blood in my sight, the pulse of my heart in my sight. It was a really profound experience. Could you add anything to that?
No. Thank you.
I'll add that, you know, it's referring to the five aggregates or the five skandhas as we chant the Heart Sutra. I think classic Zazen instruction is to keep all of them open. When we're sitting, we're not trying to go to some other place rather than the present, but to be able to hear, smell,
taste,
touch. You know. Those of you might be tasting your saliva, touching your mudra and your breath at your abdomen, and you know, the sight, vision, the eyes would go along with that, to treat them all equally, to have the vision of, you know, whatever it is that comes forth when you're unfocused view of the wall and that screen that's there, the screen of life. And for me, once again, the importance that that adds to my alertness, my presence. All the skandhas being open in person. Thank you for your question. I did not come here to make you Buddhist or to become Zen practitioners. I came here so that you might learn who you are. Mm. Those are the last words I heard Kobin say. Mm. I want just to plant those with you, and hopefully that our brief chat this morning will bring us back around to that. That's sort of the, you might say, the end of at least my physical contact with Kobin. The beginning was once again about 40 years ago back at the Santa Cruz Zen Center, and not so much he but the others who were living there at the Zen Center with me, been practicing longer than I, told me as a newcomer that I didn't have to get caught up in a lot of Zen literature, but if I was going to read something, there were only three books that were, I wouldn't have to go beyond them. One was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. The other was Approach to Zen by Uchiyama, now Uchiyama Roshi, the late Uchiyama Roshi, and then Dogen's Shobogenzo. So over those years, my Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind has been quite tattered, as you can see. It was only 250 back then in 1974. And it's been read many times and listened to many times on the cassette version that the Santa Cruz Public Library would lend to me and play in my still cassette playing pickup truck. I was most impressed, touched by Suzuki Roshi's epilogue and some highlighted phrases from his highlighted sentences. American students are not priests and yet are not laymen, but I think you are special people who want some special practice that is not exactly priest practice and not exactly layman's practice. The main point is to practice seriously, and the important attitude is to understand and have confidence in big mind. I think we must establish an American way of Zen life. If we practice hard, concentrate on Zazen, and organize our life so that we can sit well, we will find out what we are doing. Maybe what Kobin said, we will find out who we are. So, I practiced Zazen for 15 years or so, and it was wishy-washy, lukewarm about the Japanese trappings that came along, you know, with it still as we practice here, sort of the transition from my practice in Santa Cruz to the transition up to Jikoji as Kobin made that transition. Various times ordination was mentioned to me. It was not the direction I felt I needed to go. I felt sufficient in Zazen practice. But then eventually at the time when I was a single person rather than married, Colbin and Angie approached me again, and I felt that I, in response to their encouragement to be ordained, I felt that I couldn't do it the way ordained Zen priests do it. I felt there's something between a lay practice and ordained practice. And it turned out that Angie particularly emphasized that with Colbin it's different than it might be getting ordained to a priest at city center, that it's a very personal thing with Colbin. Ordaining to the teaching, to the practice, to the basic practice that he's brought, that I adopted, that became part of me. And then Colbin and I had this understanding that it was that I'd probably seldom wear the Okesa as it is normally worn. That it'd be, he said, it'd be okay to wear it as you may have noticed me wearing it in these ensuing decades over my shoulder as a shawl. He even went so far as to say that it was okay to wear it on the streets of Santa Cruz. You know. His caution to me was to take care of it. Take good care. I don't want this discussion to be simply about the way Peter has worn or continues to wear his Okesa. But I'm interested in and want to suggest, and you probably all thought about this at some point, but maybe it's a subject of our practice that isn't brought up a lot, and that is this American way of Zen that Suzuki Roshi refers to. Those words of Kobin's that he didn't come here to make us Buddhist or Zen practitioners, but to lead us to learn who we are. To plant that motivation that we learn who we are. We've made, I think, some steps in that direction. And once again, maybe there's many who don't feel there's any need to take steps in any Americanization of Zen, adapting wholeheartedly Japanese Zen. And of course, that came from China, and that came from India, Tibet. We have done some things around here. I just point out a few of them. We start sitting our Orioki meals recently up in the community room in chairs rather than Orioki in the Zendo. We do periodically Sashin Sirohatsu in particular without chanting, without service, without Dokusan. And a few times there's some weekend sessions during the year when we spend as much time being quietly aware in nature outside the Zendo as we do inside. Relatively minor adaptations of traditional Zen practice to our setting here, in, at least in this case, in Central California. Um, In that regard, I wanted to share with you something that Judy brought with me also this morning that you might have a chance to hear too often. And but I spoke with her yesterday about her reflection on that many transcriptions she has done of Coben's talks. Brought this to me this morning that I think hasn't found its way into, it isn't here in this book, right, but it's in the new one that is forthcoming. These are Coben's words about fitting into existing traditions, you might say, is one way to put it. Fitting into what, fitting into existing traditions, be what you put it. Each person has to have a revolution and not depend only on tradition and custom from the past. In that sense, maybe I am one of the Zen Buddhists, but in terms of my upbringing, I have to say I didn't want to be a Zen person. I only looked like one. We call it a square bamboo. There are very excellent bamboo growers, and as the bamboo grows, they do some tricks, some kind of bonsai work, putting a cast on growing wild bamboo. It could be made square, triangular, go this way or that way. My upbringing made me grow a way I didn't want to. It felt comfortable, but often it became a restraint. I felt I had no life to do something. So I'm wondering what you all think of our opportunity here, what your inclination is. Have you given any thought to becoming a naturally growing bamboo rather than one that's put into a Japanese shape and form? What do you think of some of the changes that have been slowly introduced here at Chikoji that are non-traditional? Maybe you have some suggestions for other ways where you'd feel more naturally yourself in this, what is essentially a singular practice, an individual practice. Melissa?
Thank you, Peter. I really appreciate the connections that you made of how the Zen practice has traveled. Mm-hmm. It came from China and then before India and Tibet and all, and how everything really is a newness, and we're creating these new paradigms. And for me, my background, I grew up Southern Baptist, Christian, very fundamental, in Alabama. Mm. And I was the bamboo that was trapped to grow a certain way and be a certain way and all that. So much relate and resonate with that story. And I believe the energy of Coben that I feel here at Chikoji. And being able to realize that it's all so interconnected and it's all interrelated. And I would love to see, I so appreciate too having that there is a sweat lodge here at Chikoji, and there are some Native American practices that are introduced and kind of woven in, and I would love to see even more of that, the nature that you talked about, how we can be outdoors and have that as part of the practice as well, and how our practice can be in each and every moment, you know, not just the sitting. And I would love also to see some African tradition. Mm-hmm. I read a lot of African spiritualities and how this is, you know, also origins of there, the meditating and connecting, and also it all is interconnected.
Cliff has been doing a study group called Science and Buddhism, and which I at first thought was kind of foolhardy on his part, which is still also may not change my mind. I've gotten totally confused. I mean, I've been trying to read some of his suggested readings about science and its interface with Buddhism, or, you know, interface with some of our beliefs. Right? And I sort of, at the moment, don't feel like I'm anything at all, you know.
That's wonderful.
Congratulations.
So, yeah, I guess it's a good thing. You know. But there are certain... parameters to being a Zen Buddhist practitioner, it seems to me, this is just ad hoc, you know, right now what's coming to mind, but one is silence. Place great emphasis upon silence and what can be accomplished in silence, and is extremely important to our practice. So, you know, one would want to keep that. That almost seems like the most important thing to me. Maybe stillness goes along with the silence. We do a lot of moving, but it seems to come back to the cushion. Our understandings come back to the cushion and arise from the sitting practice. Right now, you know, that I guess is what I want to say, that we get this practice from a tradition, you know, which Coben brought and which has its roots in other countries and so on, but this practice is apparently centered around sitting meditation, silence, that's it.
Thank you.
Along sort of the same lines, along Todd's comment also, Peter mentioned the epilogue to Zen Mind, Beginner Mind, is his focus. So I glanced at it last night, and I also glanced at a couple of fascicles before that. One of them's called Beyond Consciousness. And basically it was to Suzuki Roshi's
assertion that returning to our tuning to our original mind, our silence, peaceful, quiet mind, was a practice, I think. And you mentioned a lot of problems that we have, but basically saying that we should establish a practice in our delusion. As I am being deluded about something or other sitting, and realize that, you know, take a breath and get back a little bit. Return to your silence, pause, emptiness.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts on Makyo.
That's deflected.
Peter once described some of his striving during Zazen to Anji in a question and answer session. And Anji said, "Oh, it sounds like Makyo to me."
You have a good memory. Could we come back to that question?
Yeah.
Trying to see if there's anything else left on the theme of our way of practice, and come back to the Makyo question.
When you were talking about silence and stillness, kind of a cornerstone. What the question that came up in my mind was, what about group practice?
What about it?
Like, can you have Zen if there's no group practice at it?
Yes.
What?
So could you?
What?
You can have Zen without group practice.
Hmm.
Can you? Is that what you're
That's
asking?
A question. Or is group practice part of Zen? And so the answer is you don't. Group practice is not.
No, for me, it's unequivocal. It's very.
So it can be done all alone?
That doesn't
work. I think Coben said that, you know, we come together to support our individual practices.
Perfect.
Well, yes. I mean, I would imagine, but is that supportive how important is that supportive individual practice? Could Zen be done without that supportive individual?
Yes.
It could be.
Coming together isn't essential.
I'm going to say it is. It is done without the group, in a way. Group's here, but in another way. I mean, as was said to me when I was struggling with the aloneness, we're all alone, in a way, even here. And maybe the support is a part of that. Recognition or cultivating. I wanted to comment on the bamboo only because, well, partly because I grow bamboo. And I've seen this shackle, if you will, triangle. It's made out of cast iron and it forces the bamboo to come square normally. I might add, quite beautifully. And it is a metaphor for culture, I believe, that's the way I was hearing it. But maybe more than that. I'm not sure, but I think when we're born, coming back to sight, I think I heard this somewhere where we can't really focus. Things are, and through, I don't know, days or maybe more, eventually, through a lot of quote-unquote support by mother, we start to, and instinct, we start to focus in a particular way. This is the beginning, and maybe in some ways of the squareness. It isn't just culturally bound. And even the idea of natural bamboo, I suppose it's eventually, actually, I've seen that now that I'm thinking of it, the square bamboo for a long time, maybe 6 feet, 8 feet, but eventually starts to actually do what it's supposed to do. Sometimes. And then also, I guess as Judy was talking on a site again, one of the things that I've noticed is, and I've seen it in another Zendo I go to, is what's avoided. I mean, the walls are all made in a neutral color, I believe, to help, partly. There's no distraction, though. The Zendo that I go to on Wednesdays has a texture on it. And also this outlet, which everybody seems to avoid. It's like this outlet. And when it's crowded, you know, there's no choice. You've got to sit in front of the outlet. It becomes kind of this really a focus, in a way. Of
an electrical outlet?
Yeah. Oh, there's one around here. That place there, that's a place where people a lot of avoid.
Long ago I did that. It was very enlightening.
I don't know. It's what Cliff and Judy and really mean. Silence and stillness is before the square tube, after the square tube, wherever you come from, whatever you do. I suppose it's the inherent nature, I guess, the Buddha nature.
Well, one of the things that's been going through my mind since I've been reading some of Cliff's suggested readings is that people don't have to be Buddhist. People don't have to do our practice. I don't think the world requires it to save the world. I think there are other ways to save the world. I mean, science has helped quite a lot, you know, and This is a type of a type of activity. I mean, religion, practice, whatever word you want to use. It is a certain type of activity that is helpful to a lot of people. It is not necessary for everyone to do it. There are plenty of ways. The concept of enlightenment means coming into the light out of the dark, and there are other ways to do it besides sitting in meditation. I think I believe that more firmly now than I did a couple of weeks ago. So I would offer that, you know, that even though we have a practice that we're comfortable with and that's helpful to us, and that in some sense defines us, there are plenty of other good ones too, you know.
I want to get back to your question, but I just wanted a couple of things just to tie up some loose ends here. There's an interview in here in Remembering Colvin that Judy did with Mike Newhall, and there's some interesting comments there about what Mike remembers Colvin saying more about the robe and practice and his flexibility regarding that. So if you're interested more, you might read that comment. And Judy added in this conversation I had with her yesterday that she remembers Coben having said that American Zen, if we're going to Americanization of Zen, was something that was up to us, that we'd have to take it in a step-by-step process. And he wasn't, and it was going to up to us to do it. It wasn't something he was going to show us how to do. And he didn't. One other entry here that you might want to read is the one by Carolyn Atkinson, which refers to that same meeting that some of us older, gray-beard, gray-headed students had with Coben. The last, the one where I heard his words the last time, is her last time with him too. She makes a much more eloquent, poetic description of the last word she heard from him, and she went actually and wrote it down. So there's a longer rendition. I think what I remember happening there, just so in case you read that and you say, well, why is there such a difference? She actually wrote down and described here his talk. He was sitting in, you know, in a formal, was sort of a formal part of this last, and once again, as she wrote that, none of us knew it was going to be our last sit with him. As we were getting up and sort of leaving the room, somebody asked him informally, so why did you come, Coben? And it was those informal words that she might not have heard that I heard than others that were nearer him. That, you know, I didn't come to make you Buddhist. I didn't come to make you Zen students. I came here to help you learn who you are. So once again, just to clarify the what seems to be different last words that she heard than I heard. Makio. What Cliff refers to, that recollection, that anecdote about my question to Angie, and I know I struggled for 10, 15 years with trying to calm, anticipating or expecting that, expectations of my, that through Zazen our mind becomes calm. Thoughts don't begin to dissipate and not appear. That may be, you know, the case for some people. But as often as I had reread this, it wasn't until the umpteenth reading, it's something just dawned on me in the very first chapter here, that Suzuki Roshi says that what we need to do is learn to accept the mind we have in Zazen. It's the acceptance that then eliminates thoughts of makyo, because it's accepting what is. And if your mind is busy during a particular zazen, our practice is to sit and accept, not try to change it.